When we talk about Bible study and reading the Bible, when we talk to our friends and neighbors and even to each other, we often talk and act like that understanding the Bible shouldn't be any problem at all. Anybody should understand it. We talk as if that's the case. In point of fact, we realize that most of us have spent a great long time developing the skills, whether we were practicing them purposely or not. We've developed the skills to understand it. We've got used to the way the Bible talks, what it talks about, a lot of the subjects that are under consideration, a lot of the places that are named, and all of that. So what I want us to talk about tonight, that's an editorial us, because I'm going to do all the talking and you're going to do all the listening. But what I want to talk about tonight is to look at really some of the major challenges we and other people have to overcome in Bible study. Now, this is not to imply either that it's impossible or even too difficult to understand the Bible, but it is just to acknowledge that when God chose to have His revelation written down in human language and then recorded on documents that then would stand the test of time and come down to us today, He automatically was accepting some of the challenges that go along with that. He did it in the ordinary way other things we learn and know about are done. And I want to do that to start with by introducing to you a piece of writing that is considered one of the great treasures of our nation. This is an artist's conception of Abraham Lincoln delivering the Gettysburg Address. Perhaps you've heard of that before. In the summer of 1863, things were not going well for the Union in its war against the Confederacy. In fact, the Confederacy had invaded the North. A line of defense was set up by the Northern armies at a city in Pennsylvania named Gettysburg. The belief was that if they could not stop the Confederacy there, the war was probably lost. In retrospect, those on both sides, as well as historians since then, agree that was the real turning point of the entire Civil War. Over a period of about 3 days, some 160,000 men, along with all sorts of military equipment, horses, and other things, engaged in battle against each other. In the end, the Northern forces repelled the attacks, and the losses on both sides, but especially the Confederate side, were heavy enough that the Confederate forces felt compelled to withdraw. The battle left thousands dead, along with thousands of animals. As the armies withdrew, the dead were left behind. The people who lived in the small town of Gettysburg were left with the responsibility of burying the dead. A local lawyer made an appeal to the governor of the state of Pennsylvania that funds be provided for them to buy a number of acres, I think it was 17 acres of land outside of the city that they might use as a cemetery. That land, that money was forthcoming almost immediately. The land was purchased. And those thousands of soldiers on both sides were buried there at Gettysburg. Because it was bought with state money, it was then decided that it should become a national cemetery. That is, one that didn't belong to the city of Gettysburg, but belonged not even to the state of Pennsylvania, but to the United States of America. And they invited one of their U.S. senators, a man by the name, I believe, of Edward Everett, to come and give the speech that would mark the dedication of those 17 acres as a national cemetery. The original date, they said, he couldn't make. He was known as a very famous orator in his time, but it took him weeks, even months sometime, to write a speech that he felt comfortable with, and the date they first set, he said he couldn't make, so it got changed to November 19th, 1863. Just 17 days before that date, the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, was sent a letter inviting him to come as well and asking him if, after Senator Everett gave his speech, and all the other ceremonies were out of the way, would the president make a few remarks of actual dedication? In effect, they were asking the president to be the guy that cut the ribbon, you know, when they have these grand openings and all those things. It was really a slight, considered by many a slight of the president. At that point in time, Abraham Lincoln was not very well liked on either side. The North felt like he was too lenient on the South, and of course the South saw him as a figurehead that represented all that they were fighting against. But he attended, and after the ceremonies began and Senator Everett got up and gave a 2-hour speech about why they were there, and then when it came time, the president stood up and in less than 3 minutes gave the speech that's come to be known as the Gettysburg Address. Most people don't even know that Senator Everett gave a speech. It still exists. It's in the archives somewhere. But the Gettysburg Address is probably the speech that Abraham Lincoln gave that he's remembered for, of all the things he did and so forth. That and the Emancipation Proclamation is what he has been known ever since in history for. Well, let's see. I think I've got a copy of one of the handwritten copies of it. This is in Abraham Lincoln's own handwriting. This is the first page of 2 pages. It was only 2 handwritten pages long, about 8.5 by 5.5 size. And this is in his handwriting, even with some editing down at the bottom where he seemed to have decided he wanted to change exactly how he would say something. But this is how it goes. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us, let's see, I've already read that part. No, it is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Many of us were required in school to memorize that. A few of us can even still say it. A few of you can still say it. Those words, less than 300 words, given in less than 3 minutes, represent what is considered by many the most famous speech ever given by a president of the United States. And his statement earlier on that men will not long remember what we say here, but they will remember what these men did here. The fact of the matter is, what he said is the way we remember what they did there. That has what is memorialized it probably more than the cemetery itself, the monument that is there, or the history books that recorded what took place there. Okay, why did I read the Gettysburg Address? We're supposed to be here studying the Bible. Well, let's think of some of the difficulties or challenges that exist in trying to understand the Gettysburg Address. At first you may say, well, I don't have any problem understanding that. But realize you have already been taught the things that stand behind the Gettysburg Address that make it possible to understand it. What if you're a person who's lived all your life in Brazil or Johannesburg, South Africa, and you've just come over to this country and one of the first things you're faced with is a copy of this document and you're asked to understand it? What are some of the challenges that a person faces in understanding the Gettysburg Address? Even the challenges we face, but which challenges have already been addressed for most of us when we were in school. They were addressed in the history books, they were addressed in our teacher's instruction to us, and they were addressed by the general knowledge we have about our nation and about its history. First challenge is the challenge of time itself. 1863, 2008. How many years is that? 145? 145. No more eyewitnesses. Many of the things that were in existence at that time that contributed not only to what happened at Gettysburg, but even that were surrounding the events of the president himself speaking, have been lost or have just ceased to exist. People didn't think they were important enough to save in some cases. Other cases, even though they might try to save them, they just simply were lost or they've disappeared, like the fictional Ark of the Covenant in the Indiana Jones movie. They just rolled it into a big warehouse somewhere and it disappeared into our government's archives. And so the general public will never see them again. Both primary and secondary sources of additional documents, records, supporting evidences, and eyewitnesses' accounts have been lost. What we have left to us are a few records of that time. What some people don't realize is a part of what was lost in time is there now exists 5 known original copies of the Gettysburg Address. When I say they're original, they really are original. All 5 of them are in Abraham Lincoln's own handwriting. And yet, they're not just like each other. They're named for the people who eventually ended up with them after the president was assassinated and after the war was over. Towards the end of his administration, before the war was over or whatever, he gave 2 copies to his 2 personal secretaries, the 2 men who worked as his secretaries in his role as President of the United States. He gave one of them the first draft that he worked on. He gave the other one the second draft, the one that is generally believed, but not known for sure, to be the one he actually took up there on the stage when he spoke. The next year, Senator Everett, who soon after that great speech, wrote the president and said, in effect said, "Mr. President, you said more in 2 minutes than I said in 2 hours." But he wrote the president and asked him, could he have a copy of what the president said? Lincoln sat down and wrote out from memory what he said on that occasion and sent it to Senator Everett. That copy still exists. The next year, late 1864, someone contacted the president and said, "We're going to do a fundraiser for the veterans of the war in the North to help them out. And part of that fundraiser is going to be, we're going to publish a book," I think it was, "and we would like to have a copy, a lithograph print we would put in this book of your speech." And so the president sat down and wrote out again in his own hand what he said on that occasion. When they received it, they notified the president that they couldn't use it because he had written on both sides of the same piece of paper. And when they made lithographs in those days, the original always had to be on just one side of the page for them to make a lithograph of it. So he sat down again and made the 5th copy. And the 5th copy, different than all the 4 that exist before it, when he made it out, it's not only written on 2 pieces of paper, but at the end of it, he signed his name, Abraham Lincoln. That copy, the 5th copy, made 2 years after he gave the speech, is the one that appears in almost all of our history books. I'm telling you this because this is one of the challenges historians face when looking at the Gettysburg Address. Which one of these 5 copies is the one that he said that day. Nobody had a tape recorder there. But wait, there were two reporters there who took notes on what he said, one of them in shorthand, word for word, and immediately afterwards went to the telegraph office and had it telegraphed back to his newspaper, the New York Times, and it was appeared in print the next day in the New York Times. And wouldn't you know it, it is slightly different than any one of the five copies we have. Does that mean he didn't make the speech? Does that mean none of them are reliable? Does that mean we just can't know what he said? Well, of course not. I don't know of anybody who would ever propose any of those solutions. It's just an acknowledgement that when copies are made of something, sometimes things change. And in this case, the copies are actually being made by the president himself, except for the one for the newspaper. And still again, the early 1900s, a lady who was there at the speech, she was 19 at the time, in the early 1900s, she sat down with someone and they interviewed her and asked her what the president said. Now, she hadn't committed it to memory, but she did report on what she did hear. And then even later than that, a gentleman who was there actually went into the studios of a radio station, I think in New York City, and sat down and recorded an audio recording that was later put out on a 78 RPM record and was sold for a while for some kind of a fundraising thing. And the name of it was called something like I Heard Lincoln Speak. And he talks about having been there on that day. This is what time has left us of a speech given just 145 years ago by the President of the United States, one of the most famous speeches in our own history. And yet, in spite of the loss of a lot and the limited knowledge we can draw from what we do have and the differences that exist between the various copies of it, including the one that appeared in the New York Times done by the reporter, scholars have no problems at all believing not only that Lincoln gave the speech, but this is what he said. They just recognize that here and there there's a word or two that's different or whatever. Like, for example, in one of the copies that he wrote out, I think it was next to the last one, when he wrote it out, he failed to put that little two-word phrase under God in it. The other copies have it. The reporter's copy has it. But one of the copies written out in the president's own hand doesn't have it. So you'll find some people today who say, well, the president didn't even say that in the first place. All the evidence is that he did. He just inadvertently himself left that out in one copy he made from memory of what he said. So we face the challenge of time. We face the challenge of history itself. Times have changed. We no longer are engaged in a great civil war. Most of the things that were such great issues then aren't issues now, at least not in the same way. None of us were alive when that happened. Those who were alive aren't alive today. Our nation has changed. The issues have changed. The world has changed. And so when we try to understand the Gettysburg Address, people like the one I mentioned, maybe from Brazil or somewhere else in the world, you need to explain to them about the Civil War. What was this war about? And all sorts of things having to do with it. How did Lincoln become president? And why Gettysburg? And why that was so important? All, you know, history helps lend understanding to what this address was about. If you didn't know about the Civil War, and if you didn't know about the battle at Gettysburg, and you didn't even know about Abraham Lincoln, to read that, other than being just kind of an interesting short document, it wouldn't mean much of anything at all to you. And even his reference at the beginning, 47 years ago, ties it very directly to 1776. From 1776 to 1863 is 87 years. And that's what he was referring back to. And then there's even the language itself. He uses that word fourscore. When was the last time you used the word score to mean 20? I think most of us have come to learn what that means, but it's not exactly a part of our vocabulary. And many of the other expressions and so forth he uses in his speech are not the way that people in general speak today. And so the time, the history, and even the language would seem somewhat odd to us. It refers to events that were current then, but have long since passed for us. The style of the speech itself obviously is not in the style that the senator Edward Everett gave in the 2 hours just before that, they're just a marked contrast between 2 hours and 3 minutes. And 13,000 and something words and 250 words roughly. And the message, the speech that Lincoln delivered was an inspirational, patriotic, honoring, brief tribute to the event that he was there to lend his name and presence to. So why are we talking about all this? Because if that's true of a document that only was written 145 years ago in our own country, having to do with events we already know something about, what must be true of the Bible itself? The challenges we face in understanding the Bible are similar. We're dealing, however, with a much larger document or set of documents, the oldest of which dates back to at least 3,500 years ago. And even the newest, the youngest of them, are over 1,900 years old. And so we have, as this little cartoon I borrowed from one of my books, we have this gap that exists between us and the original people who both spoke the things that are written here and those who received them. They would be understood much more by them than by us without us doing some work. And so that's what I just want to briefly remind us of tonight, is that as we look at understanding the Bible, the first thing that faces us as a challenge is the time gap. Where are the witnesses? There were plenty of them spread out over those over 1,000 years just in the writing of the Bible and its various documents. But they've now died. Records of their even existence no longer exist, much less if they wrote something about that still existing. All that's lost. Other kinds of evidence, supporting information that would help clarify some of the difficulties or explain more clearly some of the things that were going on or that are being talked about, don't exist anymore. God accepted these things as a limitation when He chose at some particular point in time to have this particular document, whether it's Genesis or Malachi or Second Peter, written, and gave His Holy Spirit's blessing to it becoming a part of the sacred scriptures. He recognized that with time, things that might exist at the moment it's written are gradually going to cease to exist, be lost, never be found again. Never can't be found because they don't even exist in most cases, no doubt. And that people maybe 2,000 years later would say, well, we just can't trust that this is the right thing because we don't have the original anymore. And besides, when people wrote it by hand, they tended to change things. And we don't have witnesses that can corroborate that this or that or something else about it is true. Isn't that very much like what we just got through saying about the Gettysburg Address? And yet, it really doesn't hold up. It's just a fact of history that these things are this way. And the historian is very happy to accept what we've got while acknowledging they would like to have more. But that doesn't mean they discount what we have and reject what we have because it doesn't have everything they would like to have in regard to it. So we have this great gap of time. We have this great gap of language. The various documents in our Bible was written in one of three different languages. The oldest part of it was written in the Hebrew language, a dead language. The language being spoken today, modern Hebrew, they would not have any more success in understanding ancient Hebrew than you or I would who only speak English, unless somebody should teach them. The language is that different in many ways. A small portion of the Old Testament was actually written in the ancient Chaldee language, a language spoken in Babylon at the time of Daniel and Ezekiel. That's a dead language. They stopped speaking that 2,000 years ago, too. The New Testament was written in what has come to be called the Koine Greek, the common Greek. That was a form of Greek later than the classical Greek of the great philosophers and scholars like Plato and Socrates of several hundred years before the New Testament. But it was a common everyday language of much of the Roman Empire in New Testament times. That language has also ceased to be used as a living language. Those who speak the Greek language today, modern Greek, there's a few things about it that are similar, but the similarities are about as similar as us listening to Chaucer and trying to understand what he was saying when he wrote in what, around 1400 or 1425 or something AD. And that's only somebody who was just 550 or 600 years ago. What happens when you're trying to hear someone speaking your language 2,000 years ago? That's the challenge even someone who speaks modern Greek faces when they look at New Testament or Koine Greek. So we've got three dead languages. That doesn't mean we can't know what they mean. It just means that's a challenge. We've got a vocabulary that we have to learn what the words mean. We've got a grammatical structure that lets us know, how they speak. Grammar is different in different languages. Some languages they distinguish by putting the endings on the end of words as to what that word means and where it fits into the sentence and so forth. Other languages do it more by the placement of the words. Like in our language, our basic placement of grammar is subject, verb, predicate. Ever hear that? That's English. That's not the case with some other languages, including the Greek language. It primarily focuses on the endings they put on their words to determine whether it's the subject or the predicate or whatever. So the language is a challenge. On top of that is the history itself. We know very little, except as students of the Bible, what was going on in Bible times. Ur of the Chaldees, once the center of ancient civilizations. What do we know about it today? The Canaanite peoples that were in the land that Abraham came to, the Egyptian Empire. Maybe we know the most about it simply because they seem to be constantly doing specials on television about them and people are fascinated by the Egyptian culture. But the Philistine culture, the Israelite culture when they first came back into the land, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks under Alexander the Great and the period of time after that, even the Roman culture and their history, their political, their economic, and even their religious beliefs, practices, and how that influenced their world. There were nations, there were events, there were all sorts of things that happened and influences that were at work as these documents are being written that all tie back to the history of the time. That doesn't mean it's impossible. It just means that occasionally we'll find something pretty challenging to fully understand it. Then there's even the culture itself, beyond just the history itself, the way people lived, how they made a living, how they interacted with each other, their familial situations, that is, their family situations, their societal interaction. There's some of them were structured with levels, you know, an aristocracy of the middle class and a lower class. Others were structured differently. Different religions in the different places, laws, traditions, beliefs. All that comes into play because the writers in the various documents in the Bible not only live in those times, but they're writing to people who live in those times. And sometimes, many times in the Scriptures, they either make an appeal to or trying to refute something that's a part of the culture as they write. And as more we know about that culture, the better. But at that point, we refer back to point number one. Time tells us we've lost a lot of the information. We don't know as much about the culture as people 2,000 years ago, for example, could know about it because so much has been lost. Whatever written records exist have mostly disappeared. Monuments, physical evidence of other kinds have, we're just the passing of time. And so we face some challenges. We face the challenges of geography, where they live, deserts, mountains, rivers, oceans, and not just the physical features, but even national boundaries between nations, the kings that sat on them. Even the botanical and zoological aspects, the plants and the animals that live there. They'll talk about various animals or trees or plants or things which we may not know anything at all about. Yet it seemed to be very important to them. And then on top of all of that is just our own personal limitations. And by that I mean the fact that we can sometimes, simply because the Bibles we have are written in English, we can actually approach them with a false sense of confidence that we understand it simply because it's in a language we understand. But we don't have all those other things yet starting to work to help us. And so we have people say, well, it just means what it says and it says what it means. And maybe that's true in a sense, but that doesn't mean that what you think it means is what it means. all the time. Because you may you're just working out of your own background, your own culture, your own language, and we often make assumptions that what we know here is the same as what it's talking about there, simply because it happens to be in the same language, which we've been blessed that, in part at least, the language barrier has been removed by good translations into our own language. So we have this personal limitation of a false sense of confidence that we understand it simply because we know things about our own present age. And on top of that, we have this challenge that, to be truthful, many of us are not very good students. Now, I don't mean to insult anybody, but, you know, maybe we were good students in school, but we figure that now that we're grown, we put away childish things. And that, you know, we haven't really studied a lot of stuff in a long, long time. And that works against us then when we're studying the Bible, because you need to be a student to understand some things. You don't need to be a genius, a master, or doctor's degree or something in order to understand what God's will is for us to be saved, what the gospel plan of salvation is. But there are some other things in here. You need to be a good student to start getting a grasp on it. And then on top of that, I think I have observed that many people are not very critical readers. What I mean by that, they will read something in the newspaper or hear it on the 10 o'clock news at night, and not ask the critical questions. And I don't mean critical in the sense of the way sometimes I mean critical when you're criticizing, but critical in the sense that says, how do we know that? Who said that? What's the evidence for that? Is there any evidence to the contrary? Is there any way I can verify this? That's what I mean by critical. And so we have things that appear sometimes on the, you know, at the stands at the checkout counters of grocery stores and other places, you know, two-headed UFO alien found in Kansas, you know. Well, how do we evaluate a story like that? It's in print. Does that mean it must be true? Well, unfortunately, we know, I think even all of us are at least critical readers enough to want to challenge something like that, but there's a lot of other things we hear that we don't challenge. That's called critical reading. To ask the right questions, to be willing to try to find and examine the evidence, to think through the logic and reasoning of the one who's written this or said this to see if the evidence or premises they've laid out support the conclusion they've drawn. And then again, many of us may not be as well read as we ought to be. That is, we don't have a wide background knowledge in history and other things that would help us understand things more easily. I'm just saying these are some of the challenges that we face. So is it possible to cross all these gaps to get to what the Bible documents really said? I think so. In fact, I think it's always been the assertion from the beginning of the Christian age till now that we can do that. But it's just we need to start out by recognizing some of the challenges we face in doing that. That we're going to have to deal with a time barrier and the fact that many things have been lost. That even if there are 25,000 partial or complete copies of the New Testament in existence from before the period of time where printing was invented. Some people say for them that's not enough, while five copies of the Gettysburg Address is more than enough to convince them that's real. You say that's a part of being a critical thinker. There's something wrong with that picture when people will accept one thing based on five copies of a document and won't accept something else based on 25,000 copies of it. But we need to acknowledge that that is reality. We don't have the originals. And we're not even sure with the Gettysburg Address of the five copies in Lincoln's own hand. We're not sure any one of them was the one he held in his hand when he was up there speaking that day. Absolutely no one has any idea. That's why they ended up settling on the last one that was made some 2 years after he gave the speech in his own handwriting as the one they've accepted, even though it's the one furthest from the point of time when he gave the speech. Well, as we move forward into this, it won't all be as technical, and maybe this is even dry and boring to you, as this is, but I just want you to realize that then as we start, again, looking at how we can know things in the Bible, we really will be trying to address the very issues we've just been talking about. Time, language, history, culture, geography, and overcoming our own limitations. That's what you do when you study the Bible. You have to start talking about what was happening back then. Time-wise and history-wise, you have to talk about the language, the Greek or Hebrew. You have to talk about the culture, what people's practices and beliefs were. that shapes some of the things that's going on. You have to talk about the geographical aspect of it, because many of the things are happening in specific places, and that sometimes has pretty dramatic effect on what's being talked about. Well, that's enough for tonight. Any of you that have a computer and like to get on the internet, if you're familiar with this thing called Wikipedia, you can just go to, you know, type in wikipedia.org, I think. I'll take you there. Look up the Gettysburg Address. 14 pages. Fascinating to me. I think you might find it interesting too. But what's so fascinating to me about it is not just that in and of itself, but how many parallels, as we've already tried to point out, between the challenge we face in understanding it, the challenge we face in understanding the Bible. Mark has an invitation song for us. God has spoken in history. He spoke to the people of the time when his men were speaking, but he and they envisioned that being a message for all time. I like Paul's statement in Romans chapter 15, verse 4, where it says that those things were written for our learning, even though they were first spoken to somebody else entirely. But God intended that they would be for our learning as well. And again, in 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17, where he said that all the Scripture is given by inspiration of God. That even meant the stuff written 1,500 years before Paul's writing. And yet he says, and is to be used for teaching, instruction, correction, rebuking, training in righteousness. So he understood that what God had inspired, even though some of it was 1,500 years old already when Paul is writing, God still wanted present-day people then and present-day people now to be using it to equip themselves. If there's any way any of us need to respond to the gospel or an invitation for prayers or courage or encouragement, please come and let us know now while we stand up and sing the song.